Cooking for Politics podcast is brought to you by Global Pulse Media, which has partnered with Hivecast FM, a firm that assembles a creative and professional team that takes podcasts such as Cooking for Politics to the next level. This team handles all audio and video editing services. So for a nominal fee, you will get a personal account manager that helps take the headache out of editing and just leave podcasters like myself focus on just creating good content for their audiences. So if you're a podcaster listening and need help editing, feel free to reach out to me. I can be reached at cuckoo4politics@gmail.com. I could not have succeeded without this talented team at Hivecast FM. This is Michael, host of the political podcast, Cuckoo for Politics. I am so passionate about politics, hence the name Cuckoo for Politics, and I hope you are too. Thanks for joining. This is a podcast discussion on political perspectives on various issues that matter with citizens of the world. So I do ask that you grab your favorite libations, whether it be coffee, tea, water, juice, beer, wine, or a spirit or two, and let's get ready for some lively conversation and let's learn something together. This is Raw and Cut. It is a special political series where I have candid discussions on a whole host of political topics. Depending on the intensity of the subject matter, you can occasionally find this episode to be of serious nature or could be lively, hence the name Raw and Cut, as sometimes my guest and I make fun of a particular topic or point out the hypocrisy of any given issue, as politics in general can be a mixture of both. This episode is specifically titled The Wrap-Up, as the podcast closes out the 2023 political season. Based on the podcast popularity from numerous feedback emails, by the way, thank you, my political sidekick and I got together to converse on just a few more suggested topics made by some of you as we wind down the season. Part one of the wrap-up will cover subjects concerning U.S. immigration, the surge of U.S. workers enacting union activities, how the Supreme Court justice, in particular one Supreme Court justice, seems to be compromised, and how the ill effects of Trump's character and actions have somewhat demoralized religion and the country's political discourse. Joining me in this discussion is my guest, Sam Jean. Those that follow the podcast know and are very familiar with our backgrounds. We've had a series of Raw and Cut episodes together. Past episodes, in fact, can be found on the website cuckooforpolitics.com or the podcast platform you are listening to the show right now. If you are not aware of who we are and new to the podcast, first let me say thank you and welcome. But I don't want you to feel left out. So in brief, Sam and I have been friends for decades, since our collegiate and postgraduate years. Each of us have earned our respective degrees with distinction. Moreover, we have actively participated in various forms of political activism while working in our professional fields. But what makes my guest special, or why I ask him to be the podcast political commentator, is that he has established his own consulting firm, appeared both in Canadian and U.S. media outlets, discussing both domestic and foreign policies, and is also an adjunct professor in law and communications at accredited university. We are both cuckoo about politics, hence why we get together from time to time to discuss the various political topics of the day. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Cuckoo for Politics, and let's get ready for some lively discussion while learning something together. What's up, good people? Michael here, host of the political podcast, Cuckoo for Politics. Once again, thank you for your loyalty. Thank you for subscribing, and thanks for listening. Ladies and gentlemen, as always, I always talk about my Raw and Cut buddy, Sam Jean. We talk about various things. In the previous segments, you've probably heard our commentary on the GOP, the presidential race, and so forth, and the likes, education. And we always go into various topics, discussions, and even veer away from, you could say, so to speak, of our outline that we planned out. This segment will be just basically closing out the 2023 year. Sam, welcome back to the program. As we close out the year, there's so many big issues that took place. I don't even think we could narrow down to one. It's just so many, and we probably do not have time for all. I'm just going to ask you a couple of questions regarding subject themes, and then you just give me your response on that. One of the biggest things that we talk about is, or that's on the media and in the newspapers, and people actually have a concern, is immigration. They talk about the southern border. And this was an issue that's not new, for we know it that even George W. Bush had an issue to deal with, had struggles finding a solution to the border crisis. And his successor, President Obama, had the same issue. Trump had the same issue. One would argue his rhetoric built the wall satisfied people, and there was no new wall other than to rebuild walls that already existed. But people still have that issue. And now President Biden, it seems to be a growing process. I mean, a growing problem for the administration. And I just read in the Wall Street Journal that it's not just people coming from Central America. It's also people coming from India. And I'm like, how the heck do Indians are getting over here? And they said they're flying into America. Not flying to America. They're flying to different parts of the world because I guess they have special visas and they may not work to get to the United States, but to other parts of the country, particularly Mexico. And they are also part of that migration to North America. What do you think of the immigration issue? And what is it that the administration and Congress can try to do to curb the influx of migrants coming into the country?
Well, one of the sad realities that we often don't talk about is the fact that part of the workforce of this country is dependent on illegal immigration, honestly, right? And so immigration tends to be a thing that is seasonal. The government is able to predict when they're going to get more migrants coming through. You know, they tend to die down in the wintertime, but ramp up when the weather is better and people can actually travel. The issue of immigration, I used to downplay it a little bit, but I don't downplay it anymore because you have people in New York City who I know who identify as moderate Democrat, they're having issues because they're saying, hey, the migrant situation is a bit much. I do think that if you pay a lot of attention to it, people will begin to notice it. Me in California, I haven't seen, and we're a border state, right? I haven't seen a large influx of migrants in Southern California, but I'm not in San Diego. I think that the immigration policies of this country need to be overhauled. I think that you have to bite the bullet and do what Reagan did. I think that you have to give the people who are here amnesty, give them an opportunity to come into the system, give them an opportunity to at least have privileges. I think that that's part of how you address that issue. But in terms of securing the border, because the implication is that the border isn't secure. Again, there are tons of people who immigrate. Most of the people who come here who immigrate illegally aren't people who are crossing the border. There are people who get a legitimate visa to be here, and then they end up overstaying their visa. Okay, but we have to address, why is it that people are coming here? And the other thing that we don't address in terms of our foreign policy is, what has American foreign policy done to some of these countries that are sending us their migrants? Why? Why is that happening? But we have a system. You hear in Florida, right? They had made this anti-immigration law that you couldn't drive someone who you suspected was an illegal immigration. And there was a viral clip going around about a congressman going to Spanish-speaking communities telling people, don't worry about the law, encourage people to come to work, because a lot of the construction that is done in the state of Florida and other states are done by migrant workers. So we have to figure out the people who are here, we have to figure out a way to make them legal. I'm for that. The rest of it, Congress has to think about this, Michael. When you applied for your job and you were given your job, part of your onboarding process, even though it was, you know, centuries ago, right? But part of your part of your onboarding process was that you had to show proof of citizenship, right? Like you had to show proof of your either citizenship or proof that you could work in America legally. Period.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
You couldn't have that job. When I apply for a job, that's part of my onboarding process. Technically, if I don't have that, the job is not supposed to hire me. Right? That seems like a very simple thing. Why is it then that we have all these quote unquote undocumented people who are working? Because companies continue to exploit them. Okay? There's this love-hate relationship with immigration, right? We want the labor of the immigrant, but we don't want the immigrant to have some sort of social, political, residential legitimacy.
No, you're right. And I, it's funny that you said that during the summertime, these, you know, the influx of migrants coming in earlier. And I recall dairy farmers in the state of Wisconsin was advocating for the administration to grant special visas because they couldn't find people to come to milk cows because they said the Americans that were there, most of those workers or people who live in those communities leave. They go to school and they leave. No one stays. I mean, that's an industry that I won't say is dying, but it's not as attractive working in agribusiness, whether it be the dairy farms or going into the fields and picking strawberries and stuff. That's hard labor work.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard labor, but also I don't want us to ignore the fact that someone was living somewhere else and the conditions where they were living were so horrible that they took everything that they owned and their children, and they marched. That I can't imagine doing that. And I think that we lack a certain amount of compassion. And oftentimes they're coming from countries where our foreign policy is directly related to what's going on politically in their country now, which is why they're trying to get out. And if that is the case, then we have a responsibility to them. But Americans have this issue with immigration, part of the way it's framed, and it's an interesting framing, especially from the conservative perspective, is they frame the immigrant as, and Mike, this is historically accurate, they frame the immigrant as a competitor to the American worker, okay? And so they say, hey, listen, this is getting out of control. These people are coming and they're going to steal your jobs. This is why your wages are depressed, right? This is why your wages are depressed because they can go in front of Home Depot, pick up a couple of day laborers. This is why you can't get $20 an hour at your job, right? They link these things together, which are not together, okay? And so people see the immigrant, they see the migrant as competition, okay? For services, for citizenship, for work, when that is in fact not the case. And instead of having some empathy and some compassion, like if someone left, someone walked 2,500 miles, crossed water crossings to get here, what does that say? That's a person in need, right? And there are ways for us to do it compassionately. There are ways for us to integrate people compassionately, but there's not the political will to do it. Okay, so you have people in New York saying, hey, you're not doing anything about homeless people, but you're putting migrants up in hotels. How do you address that?
Yeah, and I remember a couple of things in your comments is that every country is dealing with some type of immigration issue because of geopolitical events that have taken place. And you mentioned about American foreign policy. And we could go back in history. One could just easily Google the amount of laws that were put in place in the U.S. alone that dealt with the too many of, and I'll use in quotes, them coming in. It could be the Irish, it could be, you name it, the list is endless, and Chinese, and they've always laws to minimize that, not realizing that they also need those workers. But here's another thing too. I look about the issue, the crisis that goes on in Ukraine. You have people selling or leaving their homes to go to nearby countries like Poland and Hungary, Romania, you name it. You have the current Israeli conflict, people are fleeing to go to Egypt, and every type of country is like, you know, we can't take, there's too many. These issues of Venezuela, failed state, Haiti, a failed state. I mean, these are part of their own self, self-inflicted, but part of it is also residual effects of U.S. foreign policy. And this is what's leading up to a significant increase of people leaving no matter where they are to going somewhere. I cannot imagine picking up and leaving my state and going clear across where you are, walking. I can't imagine, subject to all the environment. Here's something else.
Go ahead, Michael. No, I was agreeing with you.
Okay. Here's another thing. As we talk about what was going on throughout the year, is the issue of the labor movement. You see the writer's strike, you see the actor's strike. We talked about auto workers that are, you know, striking, industries in a railroad system. You have airlines, workers, Starbucks, you know, baristas. You have, what is it? I was reading even college,
grad student assistants, yes.
Yeah, they're all complaining about they're being overlooked, overworked, underpaid. What do you say? What does that say? Was, I guess, hey, you know, I was a Bernie delegate. Bernie, I mean, he was right about the issue of labor, where we need to pay workers.
Well, I mean, obviously, I have very fond feelings for the senator from Vermont. As a matter of fact, in terms of people with political charisma, I think he has a lot of political charisma, and I think that he has done a lot to talk about the issues that relate to workers that politicians tend to avoid. I always reference our history past. And we know a little bit about the history of labor in this country. And one of the things that I am moved by is I am moved by the fact that in the writer's strike, in the UAW strike, it seems like the public understands that the workers have no leverage and their only leverage is to strike. And when they start striking and they start explaining what they want, regardless of how the media tries to interpret it, like, oh, well, they expect, you know, a living wage, the shock of it, right? like, God forbid somebody gets a wage that allows them to live. I think that most Americans look at it and I think the writer's strike in particular, when you look at the heads of the major studios and you look at their salaries and then you look at the average writer, contrary to what people think, they think that because something's on television or because an actor's on television or a writer wrote a show or it writes on a show, they think that all these people are multimillionaires, right? And that's not the case. Most of them are working hard like every other American, right? Most of them are just working their job like every other American works their job. They're not in some high tax bracket. But one of the things it demonstrates is the power of labor and organizing labor, because the worker by themselves do not have sufficient leverage to stand up against the corporations. They just simply don't. Do you think one worker could stand up to Ford, Chrysler, GM? Not at all. And so this demonstrates the power of labor. And hopefully this is a renaissance for labor movement to come back, because for the past 20 years in the courts, there has been this move to sort of weaken the power of labor unions. And of course, companies like that, because then they don't have one group that they can collectively bargain with, right? Like they can just basically do what they want, and they can deal with the individual on the individual basis. So I'm happy to see where the labor movement is going, and I'm happy to see that young people are really invested in the labor movement, because that's part of changing the way our economic system works. It's always going to be capitalism, but you have to do what you have to find where you have leverage and where you have power in capitalism when you're the worker. And finding that is few and far between.
And it doesn't help. And I think you said it, that the American public is seeing that and siding with labor, because we're seeing corporate profits go high, like egregiously high. We hear reports about companies knowing that people are struggling and they still increase the cost of whatever goods they are selling. We see a man who we all rely on, who created or took advantage of the whole market as far as Amazon, keep going up to space. We're like, okay, this man is going up to space all the time, yet this worker is struggling just to keep ends meet. So I think we are seeing a lot of that, people citing that, you know what, it's time for the worker to get a significant pay raise, compensation benefits, because these billionaires, and there used to be, I think there was a report that there used to be few and far between, no, there used to be many, but there's so many few. There's like three or four who would like really control the American market per se, as far as being super rich.
Well, I mean, this is why people should have voted for Bernie.
Bernie.
I'm just saying, this is why people should have voted for Bernie. Because these are the issues that affect the average person. Because whether you're MAGA, whether you're not MAGA, if you're an average American, most people in this country don't have the kind of wealth that the top 3% have. Like, most people don't. Most people don't have the power to fight against the companies. Most people don't have actually the kind of power to fight for the wages that they want. Most people don't have that, right? And so in a capitalist system, which really gives power to the market and it gives power to the company, there needs to be some protection for people who work. There need to be some. We have a phrase in this country, and it always offends me, when we say the working poor, right? Like, that phrase in and of itself should be something that drives people crazy. So you actually have people who work, but it doesn't matter how much they work, they remain poor.
Yeah, they're distracted. They're distracted by CRT or drag queens and not realizing.
Yes. Like no, but for them, these culture issues are much more important. And this is, I think, was generally the message that Bernie was kind of giving, is that, hey, listen, we might disagree on this thing, but the average American is getting railroaded by the system, and that we need to put checks in place to protect the worker from the abuses of corporations and the abuses of the system. And I'm happy that young people, I'm happy that unions continue to fight, because but for unions, you would have people working 16 hours a day.
You know, that's right. And it's have to educate today's workers and tomorrow's workers about the importance of the labor movement. Something else I want to touch on is, you talked about Bernie saying that we have more in common, and that was part of his 2016 and 2020 campaign rhetoric, and people really sided with him, particularly in the 2016 race. We would normally rely on the courts to support us, but now we see the politicization of the courts, the judiciary branch. So what do you make of that now we're seeing, I'm just going to use the Supreme Court, Judge Clarence Thomas. The man is literally hanging with big donors who are paying for everything, taking him on lavish vacations to paying for anything he wants. And we're like, you're supposed to be impartial? I mean, is he another Tim Scott? But anyway.
there's a pattern here. I'm not going to. So this is the ridiculousness of it all, right? Let's talk plainly. If you had a case in front of a judge and you knew that he had taken money from your opponent, you would not feel comfortable in front of that judge, period. Right? We give this myth and we push this myth to people who go to law school. We push it to law students. We push it to lawyers. We push it to students who study government, political science students, history students. We push this myth about how special the Supreme Court is, right? And we say that the people who get on the court, even though they may have different political ideologies, that they have a certain moral compass, right? They have a certain character, and there are things that they're not supposed to do. We say that of the Supreme Court. In your municipal court, it's the same thing, right? Judges are held to a certain standard. They're supposed to have a sense of integrity. Here you have a guy who is taking trips with mega donors who have cases that may come in front of him. His wife works for them. He's giving a loan for something that he never has to pay back. Some donor pays for his grandson or step-grandson or grandnephew to go to a private school. The same person buys his mom's property, his property, for more than market value, but his mom continues to live on the property, right? All these things. And they're saying, oh, well, his disclosures, he didn't fail out. It just looks wrong, right? It just looks wrong. But this is what some of the members of the Supreme Court feel they're entitled to. Thomas, Alito, do not believe the rules apply to them, period. And if you go out and you try to expose it, they will go on the pages of the Wall Street Journal talking about their integrity is being assailed and it's being attacked. And you see them continuing to do these things, cozying up with donors, not disclosing things. And this has led me to believe that there should be a limit on how long people are in the Supreme Court. When I went to law school, I wouldn't have said that, but there should be a limit to how people are in the Supreme Court, period. Because this lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court invariably demonstrates that certain people will end up being corrupted. And there's no doubt in my mind that Clarence Thomas is corrupted.
Talk about corruption. Let's go into religion.
Great. Wait, my mom hears this. I'm gonna get a beating.
No, I'm just joking. It's just, I don't know. It was something that popped in my head. Now, as far as we both went to, upbringing, religious background, negating that aspect of it all, it's the weaponization of religion that's being used. And I think we're going to even see it more in the 24 elections because that's what I see. You already see it being played in Congress. We talked about how the speaker prayed with his colleagues and he talked about how the Bible is his center of how he's going to lead the Congress in that session. What do you see with religion being continuously, should I say, being used as a weapon to mystify their followers?
Well, this is a tricky question. I told you could ask me anything, right? So I'm gonna have to be.
And we'll close out with this.
But I'm gonna be brutally honest about this. I am a secularist. And what I mean by that is when I think of government, I think of government as being a-religious. When I think of government, I think the U.S. does have it right in the sense that theoretically there should be a separation of church and state. Even from the tradition, the religious tradition that we come from, for example, everybody has different ideas within the Protestant contingent, there are numerous sub-branches who have different ideas about lots of things, the role of women, dress, alcohol use, what you can eat, right? The spectrum is wide. And so I don't want anyone making rules based on their religious beliefs. I don't. I know what it's like to live in a house where the rules are based on religious beliefs, okay? But my dad, for example, had certain rules. Like my sister never wore pants when she was growing up, right? She was from that tradition where she always wore dresses, okay? That was how my dad was raised in the Protestant tradition, and that's what he believed, all right? Now, that's good for his own personal belief, but I wouldn't want that kind of belief being enshrined into law, right? There is a separation of church and state because we understand in this country that there are people who believe and there are people who don't believe. And we have to treat people who believe and people who don't believe the right, the same way. And you don't need to insert religion into it to have an outcome that is fair. Okay, so can we use religious ideas to form certain laws? Of course we can. Of course people do. Okay, but the laws are sufficient as they are written, without a hint in a hinge of religion. And also, when you're using religion, so what does that do to the person who isn't part of that particular faith you're in? What does that do to someone who is Jewish, someone who is Muslim, someone who is Catholic? How about someone who is Protestant but isn't part of the denomination you're part of? These are things we've talked about this offline, Michael, but these are the things that I thought were settled when I was going through law school. I thought we understood that we have a separation of church and state. Nowadays, it looks like, here's a funny thing too, is allowing your religion to be used as a political weapon. Does anyone really believe that Donald Trump is a Christian?
I know.
Does he even know the Lord's Prayer? Come on.
The Lord's Prayer.
But they bended themselves because for whatever reason, okay, they bended themselves to this idea that somehow Donald Trump is a model of Christianity. They're going to come to the, you see pictures of them, come to the Oval Office and lay hands on him. Meanwhile, in book after book, people are saying Donald Trump thinks these people are weirdos. He thinks they're crazy. They came to put hands on him. He was like, what is that about? Right? But
exactly.
They will say, religious-wise, well, you know, he comports, he's a Christian, he's more of a Christian than Biden, you know?
A devoted, like, Catholic.
It's madness. I actually would have more respect if they were like, oh, Donald Trump's an atheist, right? Like that would get my respect more if they were like, oh, I don't believe he's a Christian. I believe he's just saying that, right? But he's going to fight for what I want. So that's what it is. But there's also a thing that is anti-Christian about it also, is you have a religion that is supposedly comes from the oppressed, right? A religion that comes from people who are powerless, right? The avatar of the religion is considered the son of God, a person who, during his execution, we're told he could have stopped it at any point, right? But he did not. He wasn't a person who was in pursuit of power. And it is a little distasteful to me that this religion, which isn't built on pursuing power, is now interested in pursuing power. We know what the world looked like when Christians were running things politically, right? When they were pursuing power. We know what the world looked like that way. It didn't look great. And so as a Christian, it seems to me it's antithetical to be a Christian, to be pursuing power. And that's what they want. They want power. They want all the judges on the Supreme Court. They want the presidency. They want everybody in Congress. They don't realize that they live in a country with other people who don't feel the way that they feel. And so if you want a justification for a law, it cannot be because you read it in Deuteronomy 15:12.
Yeah, Deuteronomy. Very good. They do refer to that one. They do. And for those,
I don't even know what it is. I just know, right? They may not even, but like, but that's, to me, that's wild.
And then you talk about humility, you talk about especially religious, I can only speak about Christians, right? Because I think I'm more familiar with them, right? But you talk about these sort of virtues that Christians are supposed to have, right? Things like being able to forgive people, being kind to people, not saying false things about people. All you got to do is go to Donald Trump's Truth Social feed. The man will call somebody a dog. Right?
Yes, he would.
This lying dog.
And he right? That's the way he disparages women.
Women, like he. So, what part of Christianity is that? But they have long accepted that because Donald Trump let them into the White House, right? Donald Trump gave them access to power, and they want power.
They're hungry for power. I don't even know. It's mind-boggling, very mind-boggling. And I'm just concerned that, well, not concerned. It's just going to be another show, I would say, when you see the evangelicals are supporting and they're going to networks and preach about it, about how Trump is the answer, or the Republican candidate is the answer to save America. And I don't know if you get this. I get text messages. I get emails. I don't even know how they get my information. And I would say, they would say, it goes along the lines, please support my candidacy because the devil Democrats are stealing it away, and you need me, a Christian, a former Navy SEAL, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, who are you? And they put a picture of anybody. I'm like, well, who are you? I don't even know this name. And when you look them up, some are candidates that are running for particular races. Some don't even exist.
So they
what know a scam.
They know better than to send that to me. I hope this podcast doesn't mean that I start getting these things.
No, but
right?
You know what? They go by area codes.
Yeah,
because I look at, I'm like, why would they send it to me? Oh, because the area code that I have, they assume that block of people with that area code are conservative.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's sometimes it's a blessing to live in California.
What about a conservative like George Santos? Okay, I know we're ending with a funny joke.
You and George, you know, George Santos. This is what I want to know, man. For a guy who's stealing so much money, why does his clothes not fit? Right, he walks around in Smedium, and it's not a Euro look, right? But you know the shame of it, right? The shame of it is, the man is in Congress, right? Like for whatever reason, the man is in Congress. Now that might be a failure of the New York Democratic Party. They need to look at themselves to figure out
Democratic Party or the Republican Party.
No, the Democratic Party. Because if they, let me tell you something. This is the dude who was stealing from veterans. Okay, he stole puppies and
dogs.
That's
right. That's right.
Like, come on, man. This is liberal New York. Okay, like right? Like, how does that person make it through the vetting process?
Oh, I see your point.
Like you have political opposition, you have opponent research. Somebody should know something about this guy. And it's like, and once he won, all this stuff is out. Meanwhile, there were newspaper reporters who were saying, oh yeah, we knew this, we reported it, but nobody paid attention to it. Like that was not doing your due diligence. That was political malpractice. But now they're trying to get rid of him. But it's an interesting thing because here's what I said about Trump. This is what I will say about the Donald Trump presidency related to all of this, right? Donald Trump just makes everything worse. That's how I feel. I feel like the reason I don't want him to be president is he makes things worse, right? If Donald Trump weren't president, we wouldn't be having these conversations about vaccines. That's the honest truth. People now, when they communicate with one another, they communicate with one another via insults, right? And something that can go viral in memes, right? People can't just disagree with you and just be like, oh, I'm going to disagree with you on that. They have to call you a name, right? If he gets involved in anything, it gets debased. And so there's this feeling that our culture, the way that we communicate with one another, the way that we look at things, it's debased. They've even debased religion. Right. To your point, we were talking about. Right. They took something that has meaning to a lot of people and they've debased it. They've turned it into a political weapon. That's Trump for you.
That's Trump for you. The Trump effect. Not only a threat to democracy, but a threat to humanity.
No. Listen, man, if aliens came down and they talked to Trump, he would ruin it. Right? Like they would destroy the planet immediately, right? Because he just makes everything, and he makes people, like the bad things in people, he brings them out, right? And it is expressed in a terrible, terrible way. I hate to say that, right? I don't like saying that about another human being, but that's my concern. And Michael, it's the end of the year, and I don't want to leave people on a bad note, but honestly, at this stage, it's 50-50. There's a very good chance that Trump could be president of the United States again. And it won't be because more people vote for him as much as it will be the way our electoral college works. But if your state of Pennsylvania, the state of Michigan, the state of Wisconsin goes funny, Trump very well could be president again from jail.
What a good way to close the series from jail. Woo, boy, we're going to have some more laughs in the new year.
Huh? Yo, the man is being indicted on federal charges for giving secrets out.
Negate the porn star incident.
I mean, come on, the man is being, are you kidding me right now? But he could, not only is he going to win the nomination, but he could very well be in jail and win the presidency.
Oh, gosh. Ooh, talk about a banana republic, as they would say.
Before I close, let me first say thank you for listening, especially those listening for the very first time. I so appreciate you. I appreciate all my listeners, and I hope you enjoyed the discussion. If you wish to provide feedback or comment on any of the episodes, you could reach me at cuckoo4politicsfeedback@gmail.com. Follow me on social media on Facebook. I could be found under cuckoo4politics, or on Instagram, cuckoo_4_politics. I ask that you continue to subscribe to this podcast, which can be listened on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever podcast platform you choose to listen to this episode. Once you subscribe, you'll be able to get the latest episodes that drops, as well as some bonus features. You can also listen to my podcast and find past episodes on my very own website, cuckoo4politics.com. Feel free to comment on either of those platforms, as I welcome all feedback. Now for my closing thoughts. I normally end each episode with a closing commentary, but considering my guests and I did not address other topics suggested by you, the listeners, I will reserve that portion in a final show of part two of the wrap-up. As you could tell, Sam and I enjoy, or should I say, cuckoo4politics about discussing various topics. So please join us in a final episode of Raw and Cut as we close out season three. We will not only cover other subject matters brought to our attention, but we will also explore how academia at all levels are being criticized by conservatives, how all persons of color are being vilified by a presidential candidate, and did you know our right to vote is meticulously being eroded away? You probably did not even notice it, as it did not get much media attention. Anyhow, this is Michael, host of the political podcast, Cuckoo4Politics. Until the next episode, stay blessed.